This is The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. This summer, we all heard the calls to reform police, even defund the police. But trying to change police culture in America is not a new idea. So why do we still have many of these same old problems of police abuse of civil and human rights of the people that they're supposed to protect and serve, many of them who are Black, Latino, or immigrants? Why is it so hard to change how cops operate? We're talking about that this half hour. We're joined by Jelani Cobb. He has been asking that question for a while now. He is a frontline contributor, staff writer for The New Yorker, and professor at Columbia Journalism School. And Jelani Cobb, welcome to The Source.
Thank you.
It's good to have you. And our phone number is 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. You can call in with a question. I want you to know also that the documentary from Frontline, Policing the Police, is 2020. Policing the Police 2020 is now available to stream on pbs.org/frontline, the PBS video app, and also on YouTube. So Professor Cobb, let me start off with a clip. This is a clip that we have with you interacting with the gang unit in Newark, New Jersey.
Almost every night that we were out with the gang unit, they got a gun off the streets.
Welcome to the FBI, pal.
At the end of one night, I talked to Officers Ruiz and Riello about what I had been seeing. I'm just going to ask you straight out, is it possible to make the communities that we're talking about safe while respecting people's constitutional rights?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Without a doubt.
Yeah.
We go out there every night.
But the DOJ doesn't feel like that's what's happened here.
That's an opinion. I mean, we go out there. It's not any disrespect to anybody out there. It's not about race. You know, violating their rights has nothing to do with that. We have a job to do. Mm-hmm. We live in a city. We care about this city. Mm-hmm. It's what we do.
And Professor Cobb, you show us in the Frontline documentary that we can see our own eyes. That's not what they're doing. And to hear them saying something different, it makes you think that there's some disconnect happening. Tell me what you observed.
Well, yeah, there was a disconnect between the rhetoric and the practice. So while they said that they didn't have it in mind to violate anyone's rights, their form of policing was doing exactly that. And I think the disconnect was also around the fact that people have differing conceptions of what their rights actually are. So that conversation, to kind of put it in context, came on the heels of a night in which they had pulled over to search a 10-year-old boy and made the presumption that the boy was a lookout for a drug spot, but there was no further evidence to suggest this was the case. And the boy's 13-year-old brother came up and said, he's just 10, he's not doing anything. And then, the officer took that as a disrespect. And it was a terrible scene. And so that, in another instance, four officers stopped someone on the street, and they were in plain clothes officers, and they were in unmarked vehicles. So the person didn't initially know that these were police. And before that got resolved, he was tackled and thrown to the ground. And, that kind of thing would happen routinely, regularly. And the police did not see that as violating anyone's rights. And so to their minds, they weren't violating anyone's rights. To the minds of the people who were actually having to interact with them and the DOJ and the ACLU, they very much were.
You observed all of this. Was this before the Justice Department issued, came to an agreement with Newark to try to deal with these abuses?
The agreement was being hammered out when we first got there. The DOJ had found that the department was very troubled and that they wanted to make some significant changes there. They wanted to institute a consent decree and bring in federal oversight. But that hadn't, particulars of that hadn't been worked out yet.
Why are those consent decrees, We had many of them during the Obama administration, and since then they have not happened under the Trump administration. Is that correct?
I think two have happened under the Trump administration, which is far, far fewer than the Obama administration had. And they have said that the Trump administration, the Trump DOJ, under both Bill Barr and Jeff Sessions, have said that they don't really believe that police departments are systemically troubled, or they have very much subscribed to the few bad apples theory.
Sure, we have a clip that reflects that.
The war on our police must end, and it must end now.
Donald Trump was on his way to victory. And from the very beginning of his presidency,
Donald John Trump, do solemnly swear,
investigating police departments for civil rights violations was no longer a priority. Jeff Sessions, the new attorney general, spelled it out.
I made it clear that this Department of Justice will not sign consent decrees that will cost lives by handcuffing the police rather than handcuffing the criminals.
So, Professor Cobb, do you think that there is a direct connection between who is president and who is able to decide who's going to be the attorney general and what happens on the streets of America?
Absolutely. There's absolutely a connection between those two things. If we had any doubt about that, we would just be able to look at the situation that arose in Minnesota and see that the officers there, or rather the head of the police union there, had directly thanked Donald Trump for giving basically a free hand to the police. And less than a year later, we had Derek Chauvin choking the life out of George Floyd in that same municipality. And so it's hard to say that leadership doesn't matter, or that the tone that's set from the top, you know, being the DOJ and the White House, has no effect on how policing is carried out in local communities.
And today we're hearing calls to defund the police, and you take a look at that in the documentary, and does that seem like something that is gaining traction? Is that something that can become policy?
So what we looked at was the experiment that Newark, New Jersey, is running in what would be called defunding the police. And I think they're very judicious about the language. I don't think they would refer to it as that. But what they are doing is moving revenue from the police budget over into other forms of social service that might be able to head off and prevent the kind of problems that the police are called to respond to. And it appears to be showing some favorable returns. They have cut their murder rate by two-thirds from 5 years ago, and they've had a 30-year low in terms of the number of homicides in the city. So it seems encouraging.
All right. We're speaking with Jelani Cobb. He is a frontline contributor. His documentary, Policing the Police 2020, is now available online. If you've got a question, call in 833-877-8255. We'll be right back.
Acting Customs and Border Protection Commissioner Mark Morgan is proud of the progress of border wall construction.
It's a tremendous achievement that we've given a tool to the Border Patrol agents to more effectively do their job to protect this country, while at the same time allowing them to do their job more effectively.
Views on the border wall from El Paso to Laredo to the Rio Grande Valley, next time on Fronteras. I'm Norma Martinez. Download Fronteras wherever you get your favorite podcasts.
Welcome back to The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. Our guest is Jelani Cobb. He's a frontline contributor, staff writer for The New Yorker, and a professor at Columbia Journalism School. He has spent time in Newark, New Jersey over the years, looking at their police department and how they have been interacting with their population there. And it is a story that is seems to be a counter narrative to what we're seeing across the United States. So, Jelani Cobb, you told us in this Frontline documentary that after what we saw with the death of George Floyd, that we didn't see, we saw marches, but we didn't see outbreaks of violence and issues like that in Newark. Why was that?
So it's an interesting story. Newark, its history is to a significant degree defined by the uprisings that happened in 1967, which inflicted damage on the city that was still visible into the 2000s. So a whole generation, more than a generation of Newarkers grew up with the visible scars of what happened in 1967. And so people, I think, were wary of going back down that road. But the other part of it is that I think there has been a rapport developing both between police and community organizations that are city-funded that helped steer those protests away from tipping over into violence in a way that we saw in many other cities and across the United States.
In the Frontline documentary, you tell some officers about your first interaction with the police and how unpleasant it was. It didn't seem to really register with them, didn't resonate with them, but we could hear it as viewers, as that this is what a lot of people go through and how this forms... This is the framework that they look at the police with. And so is that really the challenge? Can you talk about that first exchange that you had with police officers when you were a young man and how that has been like cemented into your brain and has to be dealt with as trauma?
Yeah, I was talking about being placed against a mailbox and frisked on my way home from a baseball game as a 13-year-old. And that had been a really kind of defining experience for me as a young person and traumatizing. And the officers thought that was a reasonable situation. They thought that it was just something that, you know, the person was just making an inquiry. I don't think they really connected with how troubling that experience could be for someone. And the other point was that I mentioned that as a young person, I was walking with a group of friends and an officer pulled a gun and told us to get the expletive on the sidewalk. We were walking, the sidewalk wasn't wide enough for all of us, and so we were walking just along the edge of the curb. And he thought that that was reasonable behavior for a police officer. And he said that, you know, that he could start citing the laws that allow an officer to draw their weapon under whatever circumstances without seemingly being able to contemplate what an interaction like that looks like and what the implications of an interaction like that are for an adolescent who is just trying to kind of grow up in the world. And so that was, it really was indicative, and that was all from the 2016 footage, I should say, because we've been in Newark in 2016, and our current film is returning to Newark 4 years later to see what kind of progress has been made. And the 2016 film and footage was really indicative of at least those officers not being able to recognize the bigger implications of their actions.
But also, you do talk to the union representatives, and they're able to defend these actions. Let's listen to that.
Here in the city, we got body-worn cameras. Mm-hmm. Something like 50% of the complaints made against police officers are exonerated as soon as the body cam is viewed by Internal Affairs. If there's a problematic cop out there, he's not going to be out there for long. Mm-hmm. Okay, you know, this notion that there's just, you know, this army of police across the country that are just out there just assaulting people is not factual. Those guys...
Well, if we're talking about use of violence, there are about 1,200 people who are killed each year in interactions with the police. A significant number of those people are unarmed. It's not just kind of people making it up.
Okay. Last night, there was 1 million interactions with the police and mm-hmm. nothing happened. You make it seem like they're, you know, these physical encounters with police are unjustified. Mm-hmm. You know, I think the vast majority of investigations reveal they are justified.
But I think that's what people would say is the problem, that if you have an interaction with police, a system is set up that will generally exonerate the police officer irrespective of what happens.
You know,
I think that's the criticism people are making.
That's not my view. I'm glad you mentioned it. Mm-hmm. But the investigation reveals what the officer's allowed to do, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's the beauty and the curse of social media. You see a video, everyone loses their mind. He can't do that. He can't do this. Well, maybe he actually can. You know, maybe the law, maybe why so many cops are not convicted, which is, you know, part of the uproar, is because they actually acted within their rights and within the law based on what occurred at that time.
And so, Jelani Cobb, is that actually the problem, is that these law officers can act within the law and still terrorize the communities that they're supposed to serve and protect?
It's part of the problem. There are two kind of distinct phenomena. One is the broad latitude that police have with the use of force in the country. So there are things that police officers can do that most people in the public don't know that they can do and still be within the bounds of the law. The second part of the problem is that even if they violate the law, the public is generally very reluctant to indict a police officer if he's brought up on grand jury charges, very reluctant to convict police officers if they are, in fact, you know, brought to trial. You know, the best example of that was Eric Garner, who died as a result of a chokehold in Staten Island, which was specifically prohibited by the police department. He was acting outside of police department guidelines, and he was fired for it, but the criminal charges failed. He was acquitted. And that's really kind of, it's unlikely that charges are brought, and if charges are brought, it's unlikely that they will culminate in a conviction if you're dealing with police officers.
So the police culture, we hear about this all the time, and that we have different cultures for different cities and police departments, and some to tolerate more violence than others. Does it all come down, there's a very central mindset of police officers acting as almost an occupational force in the cities that they operate in? Is that really the problem?
Yeah, that happens. That's the kind of policing that we've seen. I don't want to say across the board, but there are 18,000 police departments in the country. And so I don't want to say that every single one of them functions in the same way. But there are certainly you know, many instances where you'll find that to be the case. And the kind of equipment that we have given, that we've militarized our police departments with, lends itself to the mindset that people are an occupying army. One of the perplexing things that, you know, came to light in Ferguson 6 years ago was the number of police departments who were sending their officers out in military fatigues and camouflage. And so the question was, if you are in a city, you're not in a jungle, you're not in a dense rainforest somewhere, what is the point of sending your police out in camouflage if not to kind of convey a kind of military or martial presence in the communities where they're supposed to have a very different function than what the military has?
I have a question from a caller, and this is Jesse. Jesse, thanks for calling in. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi. Yes, I was actually calling because I have a real quick question about qualified immunity and defenses. What I know is that police usually have qualified immunity in order to enforce the laws that they are I'm sorry, they have qualified immunity from the laws that they are tasked with enforcing. But in addition to that, one of the things that I noticed is that many deadly interactions with police, a lot of the police will begin to scream at some point in time just so everybody knows, and so it's documented on their body cam, I fear for my life, or stop resisting. At what point in time does the citizen get to say, I fear for my life? And a lot of times the fear that's brought on by those officers, especially when they first interact with people, is based on their profiling of them. I mean, couldn't we profile officers the same and say, I feel like you're a danger to me? And at what point do the roles get reversed? When do we as citizens get to say, now you're being excessive, and when do we get to defend ourselves without being charged with assault on a peace officer? I'll take my answer off here.
All right, so there's a lot of stuff there. Jesse, thanks for the call. Jelani Cobb, I first want to get to this issue of, he brings up, we've seen this time and time again, where officers, they almost as if they have been trained, given a script to do this. You can hear it on the body cam where they're saying the words, stop resisting, and then they go to town. We talk about training in your documentary on Frontline, and sometimes you wonder, like, what are they being trained to do? Is it to skirt the law?
Yeah, and so, I mean, there's a lot there. I'll start with one thing, which is that in instances where officers legitimately do fear for their lives, that doesn't necessarily tell you anything because there's no general standard. We don't have a national standard. What is a reasonable situation for someone to fear for their lives? And when we were talking with Peter Harvey, who is the federal monitor overseeing the consent decree in Newark, one of the things that he brought up, which I thought was a really insightful observation, was the fact that police departments should screen for fearfulness when they're hiring people. And so you have someone who might just be a jumpy person by nature, and they go into a community that they're not familiar with, that they're not from, especially if it's a community with people of a different racial or ethnic background from theirs. And that person's on edge. They're ready to shoot the first thing that moves. They might well be in fear, but that doesn't tell you that the situation was a reasonable, that their actions were a reasonable response to the situation. And so that's part of it. The other part of it is the idea of citizens being able to articulate their own fear for interacting with the police. And I think what's happened is that the biases of a legal system that is populated and administered overwhelmingly by white men of middle class or higher background, of judges, people who have the education and means to procure a law school education and so on. But we have a default perspective on policing that reflects the racial and socioeconomic biases of the people who operate, who control the criminal justice system. So those kinds of questions are not thought about, are not brought up. Especially one of the other kinds of dynamics you see is the reasoning that police should be allowed to shoot someone who is fleeing. Because the implication is the only reason that you would flee from the police is that you are guilty of something or in the midst of commission of some other kind of criminal act. And we know that to not be the case. We know that there have been police actions and police activities that give people a wide degree of responses, you know, fear responses to interacting with them. And that was one of the things that we saw in Newark, where, you know, the officers jumped out and grabbed someone and they said, you're pulling away. And, you know, the person said, of course I'm pulling away. You know, you all ran up to me. And he was like, we're police. Shouldn't be afraid of police. And it just was a kind of absurd idea. And so, yeah, I mean, all those things go into that. And I think that until we have a system that is at least cognizant of the different vantage points and different types of relationships people have with the police, we won't be able to address the issue that the caller just brought up.
Jelani Cobb is a frontline contributor, staff writer for The New Yorker. He's a professor at Columbia Journalism School. His new film with Frontline is Policing the Police 2020. It's now available to stream on pbs.org/frontline and the PBS video app and also on YouTube. Jelani Cobb, it was great to have you.
Thank you.
When we come back from the break, we're going to be talking about a controversy over the abortion pill and access to it, and whether or not there will be a crackdown putting it back behind the shelf where many people cannot access it. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. We'll be right back. Stay tuned.